Please be seated. And first of all, on behalf of the Nevada Supreme Court, thank you so much for inviting us here to ATEC High School. I mean, it's really a pleasure for the I don't know if it's me, but anyway, it's a pleasure for us to be here, and I hope you'll learn something from the oral arguments we're going to do today, and I'll tell you a little about them in just a minute. But first of all, I'd like to introduce my colleagues here that are with me here on with the Supreme Court today. We have 7 members total of the Supreme Court, so in an effort to try and keep up with our caseload, on some cases we divide into panels of 3 to hear cases so we can get more cases decided and done. So it's a pleasure for me to serve with my 2 colleagues. Again, I'm Mark Gibbons. I'm currently the Associate Chief Justice of the Nevada Supreme Court. On my right is Justice Michael Douglas, and on my left, Justice Nancy Seda. First of all, Justice Douglas made history when he was originally appointed by Governor Gwynn to the Nevada Supreme Court and subsequently been reelected several times. Justice Douglas is the first African-American ever to serve on the Nevada Supreme Court, and he was appointed in 2004 when Justice Myron Leavitt passed away, and Governor Gwynn appointed Justice Douglas to replace Justice Leavitt. And as I said, he's been reelected three times. Yeah, he's had to run in a few elections. That's a different story, but he's won them all. And then again, Justice Nancy Seda on my left. Also, as part of history, as you may know, Nevada became a state in 1864 during the last year of the American Civil War. And since Nevada became a state, the Supreme Court was created at that time consisting of 3 justices. It's since been expanded in 1967 to 5 justices, and then in 1999 to 7 justices. But Justice Seda also has made history in a way. She is the 4th woman to serve on the Nevada Supreme Court. And as a matter of fact, the first woman didn't serve on the Nevada Supreme Court until 1992. So we had been a state for almost 130 years before we had our first female member of the Nevada Supreme Court. So Justice Seda, we're certainly proud to have her here, and she was a trial judge as well as Justice Douglas in Clark County before they went to the Supreme Court. So our point being is we want the Supreme Court and all our judiciary to be more diverse, both as to gender and as to different ethnic groups and all. I think it's very important to truly reflect our population here in Nevada and around the country, and we're doing that. I might add, I'm the oldest of the, I'm not the oldest of like that, but close to it. But since I was, when I first started practicing as an attorney here, we had no female judges at all. I mean, none in our limited jurisdiction courses like Justice and Municipal Court, which do like traffic tickets and preliminary hearings and all, or in District Court. So our first woman judge in the whole state wasn't elected until 1982, and that was Judge Miriam Shearing, who served as the district judge, and then in 1992, she was the first woman to serve on the Supreme Court when she was elected to the Supreme Court. So in the last 30 years and all, we've made tremendous strides as far as gender diversity and all on the bench. And right now, I'm proud to say that we have like 52 district court judges here in Clark County, consisting of civil, criminal, and family court judges, and I believe more than half of them are women. So that's quite a change from a little over 30 years ago, have no women. Now we have more than half of our judges are women. So we've made great strides in that area. Now, with that in mind, first of all, I want to thank a few people here before we get started with the oral arguments that have helped put this program together. Liberty Leavitt from ATEC High School, as I know, has worked closely with our court clerk, Tracy Lindemann, who I should introduce as well, is sitting over there on my right in the green suit, and Tracy's our court clerk for the Supreme Court, and she's the one that tells us where to be and when and what cases we're going to argue. She basically runs the Supreme Court, and we do what she says to do and try and get our cases out. So Tracy's there, and Tracy worked with Liberty as far as arranging this. Also, Marla DeVee, who used to be a Nevada Supreme Court law clerk for Justice Jim Hardesty a number of years ago, is also originally contacted us and asked us if we'd be interested in coming to ATEC High School. And I saw Marla, and she said she'd been up since 2 a.m. working working on a case that a writ case. So I got the feeling it's coming to us. So she had to get back to work and all to get that case finalized and prepared to be filed. And also, we received a very nice note from your student body president, Whitney Weinheimer. And Whitney, thank you very much. It was very nice of you for organizing the refreshments and leaving us this note to the three of us. We appreciate that. And finally, to all the student ambassadors that helped us out today, we appreciate that as well. Finally, we also have marshals from our Clark County Regional Justice Center. We have a number of marshals here. I know Marshall Moon and Marshall Lemke and others who are here today for security, and they kind of go with us when we go to different places in Clark County to help make sure we don't have any disruptions or anything in our presentations. Briefly, I just want to tell you a little bit about the appellate court and what we'll do today, and then we'll get started with the cases. Now, as an appellate court, as you might know, is we don't do trials. We don't have juries. We don't have witnesses. And you'll see today what we do is the case has already been to the trial court. Trials have been held in both the cases we're going to hear today. Both are criminal cases. Both resulted in convictions of two gentlemen. So they'll have a right to argue that there was errors made in their trials by the judges or attorneys or various things that they can bring up. And then we'll look at both these cases and determine whether or not there should be a new trial given to these defendants. Both cases are criminal cases that we're going to hear today. But we hear all sorts of cases. We hear criminal cases. We hear civil cases. It could be like a car accidents that maybe have serious damages involved here, and we hear appeals on that. We also hear appeals on family law cases. So a lot of our cases are about child custody disputes or relocation cases where parents get divorced and one of them wants to leave Nevada and move to another state and take the children with them. And there's a procedure where they have to go into court to get permission to do that normally, you know, when they're married, and that can be appealed. That's something the Supreme Court would look at and determine if the trial court made the right decision. And we also regulate all the lawyers in Nevada, which are in a group called the State Bar of Nevada. So if there's any discipline cases involving those lawyers, like they get in trouble or whatever, whether they have to be suspended, it's up to the Supreme Court to do that, and the seven justices review those cases on lawyers. So we do a bunch of other things as well, but that's kind of an overview. And when we do our cases today, again, it's not like TV, we don't say who wins and loses right here today. Every one of our decisions are in writing, and I know you've read the briefs and you've had access to them on these two cases today, but we read them as well. And then today, after we hear the arguments from the attorneys on each side, the three of us will meet, and then we'll go ahead and vote on the case. And most of our cases are unanimous. Sometimes they're 2-1. We don't all agree on the result. But if there's two votes out of three here, then that would control a result. And then we always do everything in writing. It's always a written decision, and probably 90 to 120 days, somewhere around that range after today, because we have to prepare it, review it, make sure we do it right legally, we don't miscite any cases, and each of the three justices has the right to get their own input into every written decision we make before it's filed and distributed to the parties. Okay, with that in mind, and again, we'll encourage questions from the students, and we can answer most questions except you can't ask us to how we're going to rule on the case today, because first of all, we haven't decided. That's why we have the oral arguments, and we have open minds, and we'll have to discuss that. But generally, how courts work and operate, and Tracy's job and others, we'll be glad to answer questions about that if you have it later on. Okay, Justice Sater, Justice Douglas, anything else you wanted to add before we go into the arguments? Okay, we'll ask the attorneys. I think are they in the back here like that. So we'll go ahead and get started with this morning's arguments. And we're going to do things a little bit different. I'm going to call the case, but then I'm going to give the attorneys a chance to, before they each have 15 minutes to argue their cases. So it's a total of 30 minutes when we hear from each side. And what we're going to do is I'm going to let them address the students first and kind of explain what the cases are about from their perspective and their positions. Then we'll get into the legal arguments. arguments about the cases. We'll be using a lot of legal terminology and all in discussing them, but we'll let them address it first. So let me officially call the first case to order, and then we'll go ahead and turn it over to the attorneys. Okay, we have case number 57208. Keonis Davis versus the State of Nevada. In this case, Mr. Davis is the appellant. He's filing an appeal from a conviction of a battery with use of a deadly weapon causing substantial bodily harm. So he's appealing from that, from a jury verdict against him. And the State of Nevada is represented by the Clark County District Attorney's Office. So in the State of Nevada, we have, I believe, 17 counties. Every county has a district attorney who represents the state in that particular county, and there, so when it says versus State of Nevada in cases within the county, that's the Clark County District Attorney's Office that's involved with that. So we have Mr. Klaus representing the appellant and Ms. Lexis representing the State of Nevada. So Mr. Klaus, if you could stand up and then perhaps I don't know if you have why don't you come up to the podium, might be better, and maybe you could stand sideways if you want and address the students and kind of tell us a little bit about the case from your perspective and then what the issues will be going into today as far as the arguments. Then we'll get into the arguments, then I'll invite the state to do the same thing after you're finished.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. If I may turn around.
Sure.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Augustus Claus. I represent the appellant, as Justice has informed you. That's the person appealing in this particular instance. His name is Keonis Davis. And you've received a pretty good synopsis of what led us to the confrontation, and we'll be discussing that confrontation in detail. Really, if I were asked to describe, using the minimum amount of legalese, what was happening in this appeal, it would be two things. The first is in that American jurisprudence, we love to have witnesses present at trial. We do not like to have absentee witnesses. We don't like to make do with recorded testimony. And that's not what happened here. The state's sort of star witness, a chap by the name of Leandre Lacy, comes to us fairly early in the criminal case through a preliminary hearing. And that's one of the initial hearings that you have when you're just determining probable cause. But suffice it to say, it's a very early hearing in a criminal case. And Mr. Lacy comes to us through the juvenile detention center where he is transported by police officers to the preliminary hearing. And during the course of his questioning, several interesting things are found out. The first is, of course, that he's in custody on a juvenile case. This brings up certain questions as to why he's there and what the nature of that case is. And during an objection, it's discovered that not only is he there for juvenile offenses, but, and the judge doesn't really want to get into those, but additionally, at that point, Mr. Keonis Davis was represented by the public defender's office. And the public defenders discover at that point that their office, in fact, represents Mr. Lacy in juvenile court. And this causes some problems. As you can naturally imagine, lawyers are, we're supposed to be loyal to our client, and so we can't go throwing one client under the bus to the benefit of another. It's called an actual conflict, and it's something that we try very hard to avoid. But here it was, kind of sort of smack in the face in the preliminary hearing.
Excuse me, Mr. Klaus, if you just maybe just indicate briefly you know, the background. You don't have to go into every detail on it. You certainly can during your 15 minutes, whatever you'd like to, but that way we can go ahead and actually get started with the arguments. So maybe indicate that, and maybe there's one other issue that you'll be talking about today as well.
There's a secondary issue as well, and that is of self-defense. The issue is, what is the proper instruction for self-defense? Should self-defense have applied to the battery count as well as to the attempt murder count?
That's great. Thank you so much. And Ms. Lexis, if you could address the students, please. Mm-hmm.
Good morning, Your Honors, faculty and students of ATEC, co-counsels, opposing counsels. My name is Agnes Lexis. I represent the state. We're also known as the respondent in this particular case. I guess if I were to give you just a brief background of this particular case, This was investigated by our Gang Crimes Bureau. As a matter of fact, Detective Andre Carter, who investigated this case, is present. What was kind of unique about this case is, I don't know if you've read the briefs, but the victim didn't necessarily want to, one, testify, or two, name whoever it was that shot him. There were multiple statements given by the victim, but ultimately we were able to get out the fact that his best friend, or his homie, the defendant, had shot him during an argument over certain things. As you all know, probably from watching TV or the news, gang-related cases are difficult to prosecute because a lot of times the witnesses are not cooperative. People do not want to tell the police what happened, and even those who are themselves harmed and suffer injury aren't necessarily going to sit in court and point out the person who shot them. And like Mr. Klaus indicated, there are two issues. It's regarding Leandre Lacy. He was 13 years old at the time that he witnessed the shooting. He was in the custody, of course, of his parents. He was not present for trial. We were not able to locate him. There was a specific statute that allowed us to get his testimony in without him actually appearing in trial. And so we used that method. The self-defense instruction, it's a little bit tricky, but we're going to argue that in front of the justices today.
Thank you very much. Okay. Before we get started, I'll just explain the procedure, how this works. If this were a trial, and we were a trial judge and you were a jury, how it would work is, after the evidence is presented, if Mrs. Lexus was prosecuting the case for the state, she would get to speak first to the jury and in final argument, in closing argument, explain why she felt the evidence proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was guilty. Then Mr. Klaus would speak second, and Ms. Lexus would get to speak last. She gets to speak, come back as a robocall rebuttal argument. In the appeals here, it's just the reverse. Because the state has won the case at the trial court and obtained a conviction, Mr. Klaus speaks first. Ms. Lexus will then speak, then Mr. Klaus can speak last. But Mr. Klaus and Ms. Lexus each have 15 minutes, so I'm going to ask Mr. Klaus when he comes up that if he wants to divide his 15 minutes, you know, like keep a certain portion for speaking first and preserve some of the 15 minutes to speak last. He doesn't have to, but you have to preserve some time here if you want to speak last. But in trial court, you don't have to do that. You get this, it's automatic, but here we got to deal with more of a timetable. So, Mr. Klaus, if you again could approach the podium here and let me know if you would like to reserve some of your 15 minutes for your rebuttal argument today, and how much time you'd like to reserve.
I would I would like to reserve 5 minutes, please, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. So we'll the clerk can we get the little note of the beeping or something, Tracy, here? Yeah, we have a little beep when we after 10 minutes are up, it'll beep. So Mr. Klaus will has a clock in front of him, but it'll also be a reminder that he's into his last 5 minutes. So if he wants to reserve it, he'll need to stop talking. And once in a while, we give a little more time if we ask a whole bunch of questions. As you can see, we'll probably have some questions for both attorneys during the course of the arguments today. So, Mr. Klaus, with that in mind, you may proceed. Again, if you want to go over any more facts, it's up to you. Or if you want to get straight into your arguments, please feel free to do so.
Honorable Justices, thank you for this opportunity to address you this afternoon in regards to the case, the appellant, Mr. Keonis Davis. Your Honor, Mr. Davis's case, the facts are largely not in dispute. The primary operative fact that is in dispute here is when the gun jammed, so to speak, when Mr. Davis shot Mr. Damian Rhodes, and whether that occurred prior to or after the shooting of Mr. Rhodes. This case presents a bit of a perfect storm, Your Honors. Either one of these issues by itself might have been insurmountable, but both of them together present a rather unique form of error. Starting with the self-defense instructions, because I believe that's really the more significant error here, The district court entertained lengthy arguments as to what should be the self-defense instruction here. And the defense's position was that self-defense operates as a continuum, starting with the basic self-defense premise that someone is allowed to defend themselves against unlawful force, and operating all the way up to what has been codified or essentially put in case law as the Runyon instructions in cases of homicide-based self-defense where there is, in fact, a killing. But in the case at bar, there was not a killing. Mr. Damian Rhodes survived, and so the question became what form of self-defense instructions should be given. Ultimately, the district court made the decision to use the exclusive Runyon instructions and only excuse either the killing or attempted killing of Damian Rhodes, and demurred offering any further instructions as to self-defense on battery. This leads to the somewhat absurd result that Mr. Davis was found not guilty of the more stringent crime of attempt murder with use of a deadly weapon, but because no jury instructions were given on the battery, the jury finds him guilty of battery. Put simply, this leads to the result that Mr. Davis, based solely upon the jury instructions, would have been better served by shooting his friend in the head than somewhere else, and just simply attempting to wound him to end the engagement. This is the absurd result that is objected to by the defense. And, Your Honor, the case law and the statute is very clear in here. NRS 200.275 makes it very clear that in addition to any other circumstances recognized at common law, the infliction or threat of bodily injury is justifiable and does not constitute mayhem, battery, assault, if done under circumstances with a justified homicide. This is precisely the instruction that the district court refused to give under these circumstances. Now, the error here is doubly compounded. On the one hand, there is no battery instruction. There is no battery self-defense instruction that is given by the court. The state rejoinder is that it's unnecessary because the jury can read the other instructions and come to the conclusion that because battery is a lesser included offense of attempt murder, that the jury can conflate those instructions together and come to the conclusion that therefore battery should have been a possible not guilty verdict based upon self-defense.
Mr. Claus, as I understand what happened, again, for the students, Mr. Davis requested the trial judge to give this self-defense instruction worded in the way you described to the jury as something to consider before they rendered the verdict. The judge refused to do so, and the judge only gave the instruction on Runyon, which was a murder case, and the one the Supreme Court approved in the Runyon case, but would not alter the instruction pursuant to the battery issues and all issues you bring up. Is that correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. But additionally, and this is what keys into the state's argument, is that the state says that you can conflate these two instructions and get to a not guilty based on self-defense for the battery. The difficulty there is that the Runyon instruction that was given by the court is the highest level of self-defense. If we look at self-defense as being a continuum, when you attempt to or need to kill someone in self-defense, the law requires that you are very sure of those circumstances, that you are confronted with some great bodily injury or death yourself. But the statutes also make very clear that if you're confronted with something less than that, you are given a broader basis upon which to defend yourself. It opens itself up not simply to death or great bodily injury, but now if someone is attempting to inflict a felony upon you, you are allowed to defend yourself.
Well, what happened, and this is kind of goes into what I think the judge said from reading the record, what in this case, if Mr. Davis, say, had been carrying a bottle, I think, of cognac. It was used, the example, maybe it's worth a couple hundred dollars, and Mr. Rhodes were coming by and trying to steal the bottle of cognac from him, as opposed to slugging him or hitting him, committing a battery. Would Mr. Davis have a right to shoot Mr. Rhodes then if it was just a threat to take this personal property away?
And I suppose that's the heart of why the district court did not give the instruction. The district court knew what the statute said, knew that it was a plain language of the statute, and decided that in creating a hypothetical situation, as you just indicated, Justice, that would create an untenable result for the district court. But that is precisely why we do not, or we hope, that the courts do not engage in hypotheticals to facts that are not in front of it. In the case here, it's almost uncontroverted that the defendant, Mr. Davis, told Mr. Rhodes that he was carrying a firearm before the first blow was struck. But that did not dissuade Mr. Rhodes. He came forward anyway. At that point, Mr. Davis was placed in the impossible position of either defending himself with his fists, knowing that he had a gun, and hoping that he could defend himself going fisticuffs, knowing that if he did not, he ran the risk of having his own gun used against him. Conversely here, Mr. Davis also had in his mind, as he's having this argument, and the testimony of Mr. Davis shows this, is that Mr. Rhodes was known to carry a gun. And based upon Mr. Davis's testimony, when Mr. Davis says, I'm carrying a gun, Mr. Rhodes says something to the effect of, you're not the only one packing heat. So there's this reasonable belief that even though he might be throwing punches, at some point this could turn into a very deadly encounter using deadly force. Now, that's the first issue, Your Honor, I believe the strongest. The second issue is really this revolving around the absentee witness, Mr. Leandre Lacy. Mr. Leandre Lacy.
Before you get to that second issue, I want to be sure that the record is as I understand it, and that is you proposed a battery self-defense instruction. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, the legal authority for that instruction was?
The legal authority came straight from the Nevada statutes, Your Honor, NRS 200.120 and NRS 200.160. It was simply the best attempt that we could at taking the precise language from those two statutes and working it into a jury instruction.
Because, in fact, this court has not yet addressed this particular issue, and so we do not have a Runyon-like or a case authority instruction that you could look to. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement, Your Honor, and that was one of the issues that we had here in dealing with the district court. The Runyon instructions have become so widespread that there is an extreme reticence to use anything but Runyon, even if the facts are such that Runyon clearly does not apply. And that's part of the issue with the state's brief here. The state says that the court just defaulted to the more specific instruction and in lieu of the general. And the more specific
in fact, here today you're asking us then to create, by way of case law, something that does not exist in Nevada law. Is that correct?
That is a fair statement, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Klaus.
Moving on to Mr. Lacy, this presents a second issue that really is important in the Keonis Davis case, and that is Mr. Lacy is absent at trial. And this is significant because, as the state indicated to the students here present today, he is the only unconflicted witness that the state has to support their rendition of events and the attempt murder charge. He comes to us through the preliminary hearing, but at the time of the preliminary hearing, it is discovered that he's actually in custody on one charge. We find out that it's a gun charge, which is in and of itself something significant, as the justice is aware that by law this is a certifiable offense, yet he has remained in juvenile court. Beyond that, we also find out through the judge's questioning, an objection is raised to going into Mr. Leandre Lacy's juvenile background, and through the course of exploring that objection, the judge says, did any of you ask whether or not you represented him down in the juvenile court? And so, in fact, Mr. Bonaventure and Mr. Guymon, who were both present and both fine criminal advocates, asked, well, do we? And the response is yes. And this stymies both individuals. At that point, the advocates and the court spend more time talking about the conflict than they do about any other questions from Mr. Lacey. The third problem with Mr. Lacey is not just the actual conflict, and it's not just the circumscription of his testimony regarding his juvenile offenses, but it is the fact that it comes out during his examination that Mr. Lacey has given a statement to police, and this statement has not been provided to the defense. Now, this is important because Mr. Lacey testifies at trial that he is substantially closer to the event than what his statement would lead our investigator to believe. And so we're unable to ask him about any of those errors or omissions, any differences between his testimony that day and the statement that he gave to police.
Mr. Klaus, you indicated that there was a statement. Were you aware that Mr. Lacey was going to testify at the preliminary hearing?
Actually, Your Honor, I was not counsel at that time.
What was counsel then? Thank you for that.
They indicated that they were aware that he was going to testify at the preliminary hearing. They indicate that they ran a standard conflicts check on Mr. Lacey, but for some reason they didn't run a conflicts check to the juvenile.
I can appreciate the rest of the answer, but I was going to move to whether or not, based upon your information, since you weren't counsel, whether they attempted to ascertain whether or not there were any written statements that were proffered or available that Mr. Lacey had made prior.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, during the preliminary hearing, they did determine that he did give a taped statement to the police and that the taped statement was in police custody. Now, the state averred at that point that it had not been transcribed, but it was available.
But you had, I guess, alluded to, was that the statement you're alluding to, or did he make a written statement to the officers prior?
No, it's the taped verbal statement that I'm alluding to, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Mr. Klaus, you have a little over 2 minutes. We'll add 2 minutes to your time here because we have quite a few questions. We'll give Ms. Lexis an additional 2 minutes for her presentation as well.
Thank you. Okay.
Your Honors, let me begin by addressing the issue concerning the admission of Mr. Leandre Lacey's preliminary hearing transcript at the trial. What I would like to make very clear is that the voluntary statement transcript was not yet available at the time of the preliminary hearing. The public defender's office became aware of the fact that they were representing Mr. Leandre Lacey during the juvenile procedure. However, at the time, the public defender also stated on the record that they had no information concerning Mr. Lacey's juvenile record. So it's the state's contention that the defense attorneys, the public defenders, didn't have any information that they could have used to the detriment of the defendant during cross-examination. In other words, there was no conflict in terms of what they were asking, and it didn't cause them to omit certain questions that they would have otherwise asked Mr. Lacey at the preliminary hearing on cross-examination.
Now, Ms. Lexis, maybe a little background for the students will help, too. It's my understanding that under the United States Constitution, if somebody accuses you of an offense or something, you have a right as a defendant, a constitutional right, I believe it's the Sixth Amendment, to confront your witnesses against you so people can't hide in the background and make accusations and all. You can confront them in court. However, in this case, your position is that this witness did testify at the preliminary hearing, was subject to questioning under oath by former counsel for Mr. Davis, and therefore that would be sufficient to use that testimony at the trial when that witness became unavailable. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And one of the requirements when the state attempts to use a preliminary hearing transcript at trial is that the defense attorney who represented the defendant during the preliminary hearing had to have had the opportunity to cross-examine the witness. In this case, the defense attorney absolutely had the opportunity to do that. In fact,
Ms. Lexis, let me ask you a question here, just so that we can keep the facts clear. The witness obviously was available at the preliminary hearing.
Yes.
And defense counsel had an opportunity to presumably adequately cross-examine him.
Yes.
But without the statement that you say was not transcribed, was defense counsel able to test the credibility of the witness's testimony against a statement that was given more closely related in time, at least to the event?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely.
Now, how? If he didn't know it existed and he didn't have a copy of it, how was that tested at the preliminary hearing?
Lacey's testimony at the preliminary hearing was in no way inconsistent with his testimony or his statement taped by the detectives.
But you know that. Defense counsel doesn't.
Correct. But I will note that the voluntary statement, Leandre Lacey's voluntary statement, was ultimately admitted into evidence at trial. And it was provided to defense counsel shortly after the preliminary hearing. And defense counsel then, after receiving the voluntary statement, seeing the statements that Mr. Lacey made at the preliminary hearing and then in the tape statement, was able to, in a sense, impeach Mr. Lacey with what he said at the preliminary hearing transcript and what he said during the voluntary statement. I've made a chart. Defense counsel, the public defender at the time of the preliminary hearing, asked Mr. Lacey about his criminal history, what he was in juvenile for, juvenile detention, his bias and motive towards testifying for the victim, his lack of a friendship with the defendant. He was able to question him about Mr. Lacey's opportunity to have observed the incident that he was testifying about. And these same facts were talked about during his voluntary statement. Now, the voluntary statement, which was admitted at trial, at the defense request, no objection from the state, did go into a little bit more detail about some background information. And I'll note that on closing, the defense attorney actually said, that's the problem with Leandre Lacey's statement, meaning he didn't know exactly where Mr. Lacey was standing. That appears to have been the main issue from defense counsel. Didn't know exactly where Mr. Lacey was standing, so that it was difficult to ascertain what he could see, what he was able to hear and observe. However, defense counsel then goes on to say, other than that, it's a great statement. Now, at the preliminary hearing, Mr. Lacey testified that he was approximately 38 feet from the incident between the defendant and the victim. He was near the mailboxes. In his voluntary statement, pretty much the same effect. He was able to see everything clearly. He saw everything, heard the click of the gun. The defense attorney actually then, after receiving the voluntary statement, was able to have a defense investigator go out to the scene and measure the distance between near the office and the mailboxes to where the victim's body was ultimately found when he was shot, and measured it to be 110 feet. He was able to talk about that on closing, and he was, in a sense, able to disprove Mr. Lacey's statements. He had an investigator testify as to whether or not you could hear the click of a gun from the measured 110 feet away, really, the statement that Mr. Lacey made was of great help to the defense. Mr. Lacey did not testify to anything that was not corroborated by other witnesses. The only thing that differs is that we have witnesses who say the clicking of the gun, because factually we were not able to determine whether or not the shot that ultimately injured Mr. Damian Rose, the victim in this case, was the first, second, or third shot. We have evidence to support that the defendant tried at least three, maybe four times to shoot the victim. We don't know if the first shot hit the victim, and then ultimately the defendant pulled the trigger again, the gun jammed, they cleared it, tried to pull the trigger again, the gun jammed. That was the only uncorroborated portion of Leandre Lacey's testimony. Other than that, Leandre Lacey's testimony corroborated the defendant's testimony and actually helped him to establish the self-defense claim. because Leandre Lacy's voluntary statement, which was admitted at trial, actually talked about what he saw, the confrontation between the victim and the defendant, prior to the defendant shooting the victim.
Mr. Lacy was unavailable. What steps did the state take to attempt to secure the witness?
Your Honor, the state, all the way up until I believe it was June 22nd, had been attempting to locate Mr. Lacy. Now, Mr. Lacy was 13, 14 years old at the time, so he should not have been difficult to find. However, the state ran up against a roadblock, Mr. Lacy's mom. Mr. Lacy's mom made contact with our paralegal at the time and indicated that she would not be making Mr. Lacy available. Mr. Lacy was on summer vacation, this is June, was on summer vacation with his father. She was not going to tell us where. We presumed it was out of the jurisdiction and that she would not be cooperating or helping the district attorney's office or Metro locate Mr. Lacy for the trial. Our investigator, Matt Johns, subsequently ran all kinds of searches for in an effort to ascertain the location of the defendant's father. Mr. Lacy's father. Mr. Lacy's father had just gotten out of prison. He was not on parole. His term had expired, and we had no way of locating him. Our investigator, yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. Judge Adair, the district court held a very long hearing and had the opportunity to question our investigator, Matt Johns, concerning his efforts. And he talked about going to the house, last known address, the mom's house, her home, actually staking it out, parking down the street, looking for any kind of movement in the house. He was not able to do that. From the time of June 22nd, when we found out that Mr. Lacy would be unavailable, up until the time of trial, we had this hearing the very first day of trial. Judge Adair, after hearing all of this, after looking at the affidavit from the defense investigator, ascertained that we had fulfilled our duty, reasonable diligence, to locate this particular witness and allowed us to go into that testimony. With regard to, seeing my time is almost up, I'll go now, unless you have additional questions on that issue, to the self-defense issue. Thank you. Our analysis was kind of threefold in this particular case. I'll just point out first that it's our position that the court properly recognized and gave effect to this particular section of the self-defense that's now at issue. The court, after reviewing the entire self-defense, justifiable homicide statutes and case law, concluded that it could not read the statute that Mr. Klaus was referring to justify the use of deadly force in circumstances where there was no threat of a felony involving substantial bodily harm. But before we even go into that, I want to point out, I have a copy of his proposed instruction, and I hope you have the opportunity to look at it. Because the first instruction essentially says the infliction of bodily injury or the threat of bodily injury is justifiable and does not constitute a public offense if done under circumstances which would justify a homicide. That is not verbatim from the statute. It is not. There's language missing, and it's the state's contention that this particular statute is somewhat broad when you read it in conjunction with the more specific self-defense instructions. The second proposed instruction were really three different statutes kind of meshed together, NRS 200.120 and 201.50 and 201.60. And it reads like this: justifiable homicide is the killing of a human being in necessary self-defense or in the defense of habitation, property, or person against an individual who manifestly intends or endeavors by violence or surprise to commit a felony. Homicide is also justifiable when committed in lawful defense of the slayer or any other person in his presence or company when there is reasonable ground to apprehend a design on the part of the person slain to commit a felony or do some great personal injury to the slayer or to any such person, and there is imminent danger of such design being accomplished, or in the actual resistance of an attempt to commit a felony upon the slayer, in all other instances which stance upon the same footing of reason and justice as those enumerated above. Just from reading this outright, the state, the court, expressed our concern because we found this particular instruction, the way it was read, or the way it was written, the way it was proffered, to be extremely confusing.
Was there any attempt by the state or the court to make it more palatable, to make
yes.
it clearer?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. There's actually, it was a lengthy hearing concerning the jury instructions, and at some point, I can draw you to the particular page, but Judge Adair says, I have tried multiple times to try to phrase this in such a way where it makes sense, where it comports with accepted case law and also the statutes as she understood them, and she was not able to do so. What I would also point out is that since the defense was proffering this, the defense also did not make an attempt to proffer a different or revised version of
From our standpoint, though, I guess the question is, was the instruction that was offered legally incorrect?
The way it was proffered with the three statutes, I believe so. They could. However, in this particular case, let's see. I guess the main issue was that the court really took issue with the statute that said it was okay to use deadly force if the person upon which the deadly force is being committed is committing a felony. Read in conjunction with the other self-defense statutes, it just didn't make sense in this particular case. Because if you read it to mean that, you know, anytime someone's committing a felony, it's okay to use great bodily harm. And before I forget, I'll point out that that particular statute makes no mention of any of the other run-in factors, such as the existence of imminent harm or danger, such as the reasonable person standard, that it must be reasonable to use that force. It makes no mention of... That's it for now. It makes no mention of several of the factors on run-in. For instance, let's say if you were to read that statute as is, someone who commits a larceny from the person or a robbery, grabbing a bottle of cognac, if we were to read that without reading into and without taking into account the other self-defense instructions and also the case law, it would then be okay to use deadly force upon someone who snatches your purse. If someone snatches your purse and they're fleeing because now it's an attempted felony, it would be okay to shoot them in the chest. Or if there was a robbery where, okay, let's say no deadly weapon, but it was a felony of violence, and someone snatches a cell phone and takes off running, here we have a robbery, or pushes the victim down as they're taking the cell phone, then it would be okay to use deadly force.
But in this case, and I understand your argument on those types of it, but here it's some violence involved. It's a battery here. Mr. Rhodes, didn't he slug Mr. Davis or something, you know, and this is a confrontation? Does Mr. Davis have to sit there and just take the beating, or does he have a right to defend himself? And if he feels he's in serious threat, he felt he was going to be beaten to death, and ultimately that's the jury decides that, not us. Wouldn't he have a right to have that instruction, though, based on the type of crime?
It's our position, Your Honor, that that particular issue was sufficiently addressed with the other jury instructions that that the court ultimately decided to give. I mean, basically, the defense wanted to argue that you don't have to wait for somebody to look like they're going to do great bodily harm to you if you think they're going to commit a felony on you. And this could incorporate something like a robbery. The defense argued that during closing. They were not precluded from arguing those particular factors or that type of self-defense.
The defendant allowed to have a instruction as their theory of the case if the instruction is correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. But at the same time, one, it has to be supported by evidence, no matter how weak, during trial. Do I still get my 2 minutes? Thank you. And cumulative, superfluous jury instructions or jury instructions that have already, or I'm sorry, law that has already been covered by other jury instructions are not necessary. In this particular case, the four, five, or six jury instructions that defense counsel and the court and the state agreed upon did not in any way preclude Mr. Klaus from arguing what he wanted to argue based on the proffered instructions ultimately rejected, because he did make arguments like that. He was able, and with regard to the battery with a deadly weapon and how we were not, Mr. Klaus claims that the jury was not instructed upon that. In Runyon, the court alluded to the fact that, you know, without a specific jury instruction or arguments by counsel at trial, the defendant was prejudiced. But in this case, Mr. Klaus made self-defense arguments, okay, including
I
the
think
battery.
We understand that position. So thank you very much for your argument. We appreciate that. And Mr. Klaus will let you come up and give your rebuttal argument then. And you have 3 minutes? Is it four? Yeah, okay, 4 minutes.
Mr. Klaus, if you could, would you talk about the correctness or respond to the state's position that the instruction was not correct that you were offering?
And indeed, that's exactly where I was heading, Honorable Justice. Thank you. And that was the conundrum that the defense was placed in the district court trial. The defense wanted the instructions as plainly were laid out in the statute. And what the court and the state said is, and it's actually in the transcript, but it's wrong. That's just wrong. The court says, well, we all think that we can accept that the statutory language is just not true. It's not correct. And what I told the court is, Your Honor, I can't accept that. What I am giving you is based solely off of the statutory language contained in the NRSs. I'm not reaching any further. I'm not changing it at all. And while you might argue that it leads to a result that you don't agree with, at the end of the day, that's the legislature's call. And the legislature is the one that crafted this clear, unambiguous language.
The state, and you heard the argument, asserted that verbiage was missing.
Well, and indeed, Your Honor, what we're told in the Runyon instructions is that here are the Runyon instructions, but they need to be tailored for the individual events that are facing the court and the facts. And so what I did is I tried to not take all of the various bases for escaping liability here. I didn't want to talk about the infliction or the threat of bodily injury as justifiable, doesn't constitute mayhem, battery, or assault, because assault wasn't charged here. There was no charge of assault. So there had to be a way of putting those together in such a fashion that the jury could understand that the charges that it was faced with did not constitute a public offense if they believed that it met the other requirements of the justifiable homicide statutes. There were discussions about redrafting separate instructions, but at the end of the day, Your Honor, the court simply said, I can't buy that this felony can form a basis for self-defense in the battery. It just doesn't make any sense to me. I did not proffer another redraft, but I offered to separate something out, Your Honor. Ultimately, what we ended up... And truthfully, that's part of the problem here, Your Honor, because while I wasn't specifically precluded from arguing our theory of the case, as you know, closings are, you're instructing the jury that the arguments of counsel are not evidence. They cannot be taken as evidence. The evidence is what they've heard in the case before, and our instructions are just to help them understand the jury instructions. They're not the law. And so that precludes us from giving the theory of the defense when the jury instructions clearly say it's only murder or attempt murder in which self-defense could be found justifiable. Finally, Your Honor, there's the first issue that the state addressed, and that is Mr. Landry Lacey. Indeed, we did introduce Mr. Landy's statement at trial because his statement was inconsistent with his preliminary hearing testimony. And so we tried to backstop into cross-examining him, but as the justices are aware, that's sometimes wholly inadequate. What we want is we want to see that witness. We want to be able to test their credibility. We want the triers of fact to observe the demeanor of that witness. Are they combative? Are they trying to be forthright and truthful? And if you present them with what seems to be an impossibility, in this case, Mr. Lacey identified that he was fairly close to the shooting at the time that he observed it, yet in his statement he describes a place that is over 100 feet away, twice the distance away, with multiple obstructions that would have impeded his vision. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Klaus and Ms. Lexis, both of you, for your excellent arguments here today. We appreciate the quality of those for the students and for the court, and also for your excellent briefs each side's filed in this case, which the students have read. I have copies here as well. The students might have questions about briefs, so we brought them, and when we have questions and answers after the next case, we'll go ahead and discuss that. But thank you both, and we'll be at ease, and we'll let the attorneys come in and set up for the next case, and we're running a little bit